ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
So first, I offer my respectful obeisances to my spiritual masters, Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, and to everyone here today and online, all the Vaishnavas who are present or not present. And the course of human life is described by a poet, Jayadev Goswami, Kamala Jala Jala Jivana Talamala. And that is a poetic description of the tenuous nature of life. And it describes how a drop of water rests on a lotus leaf. The lotus leaf is impermeable to water, and whenever water gets on the lotus leaf, which tends to dangle on the top of the pond, then you'll notice that it simply rolls off. With every movement of the leaf, if the water moves, the leaf moves, or if the wind comes, then the water on the leaf will slide right off. It doesn't adhere at all. And in fact, it is so impermeable that the leaf, that it seems as if the water's not even touching it. So in this poem, Jayadev Goswami is describing how our life is tenuous in the same way, that there's no lease agreement that says you get a certain number of years in this world, and it can be terminated at any time. There's no clear understanding of what that may be, when that may be. So just as the little drop of water can roll off at any time, so similarly my life, he's saying, can roll out of here at any time. However, even given a very short span of life, even if one lives the full term of one's life, human life, it's considerably shorter, according to the Vedas, than at other times in history, when people live longer, and there are other species of life who live longer. That is, there are beings who have longer spans of life. However, even though the human life is temporary and short, it is extremely valuable. So how can one take advantage of the full value of life is a good question to ask. There are a lot of time management tools that one can take up in one's life. But according to the Vedas, one should particularly be attentive to one's spiritual advancement, because we're given such a short amount of time, and we don't know how long it will last. So, therefore, one should find out as soon as possible. In fact, Prahlad Maharaj, when he was a child, 5 years old, said, even from the tender age of childhood, from 5 years old, Kaumara acharat pragno dharmam bhagavatam iha dvilabam manasam janma tadapya dhruvam artadam. He said, it's not fixed that you're going to stay in the human form of life any amount of time, but you should start from the very beginning to take advantage as much as possible. And other verses in the Vedas said, as soon as you understand the value of human life, then by all means take advantage of it. It has to give an imperative, because otherwise there's a tendency to procrastinate. Have you noticed that? There's a way in which there are other demanding things, and one can also develop a sense that perhaps I'll live forever. Others may get a notice that they're going to pass away from the world, but probably I won't. Or if I do, it'll be in millions of years. And I could put things off, or I could become so distracted with or absorbed in the work at hand, perhaps trying to build a firm financial base is possible. Of course, one never knows what that means, because as soon as you get $500,000, you think that's nothing. I have to have a million, at least past the million mark. And as soon as you get to a million, prices have gone up, And you consider like 2 million is the minimum for me to retire and not consider. But it never ends. And we see that people have billions of dollars. Dale's is thinking the same way, that it's my main imperative in life is to get more financial security. But the great sages, like Narada Muni, say, don't concentrate so much on this, and there's a reason why not to. Although one can be diligent, do one's duty in this regard, because there is a way in which one must maintain oneself. But he said, don't put your heart and soul completely into it. Be methodical, but be dispassionate about it. Because, he says, there's a certain kind of ledger sheet that's kept for not just this life that we have, but also previous lives as well. And there's an accumulation of debts and also assets that we have that's been kept for a long time. Apparently, in the game of cricket, there's what's called a test match. Am I correct? I'm a complete, absolute novice when it comes to cricket. I know nothing about it except for a few things I've learned. I've only seen one cricket match at the end, and I was completely bored. I apologize if that's blasphemy to anybody. But I heard about a test match, and apparently it goes on between the same two teams over 5 days or something like that, and then they accumulate the score. So if the team, the first day scores 5 points and the other scores zero, is that possible? Or is that likely, 5-0? What's a likely score for one game? How many runs is likely? How many runs does a team usually get? No, but in one day. In one day? God, that's a lot. All right, 250 in one day? So anyway, if you walked into a match, Chaitanya Charan gives this example, so I'm picking it up from him, that you walk into a test match and you see that one team has 250. Is this making sense? And the other team has zero. So you might conclude that either scorekeeper is on one side and he's just giving him everyone points arbitrarily. Or you might just say it happened by chance. The scoreboard just runs through and it lands on any number. Or you might then say, oh, there might be another reason. So similarly, there's at least three categories of worldviews that people have. Some people say everything's happening by chance. So when I'm born, whatever I have and whatever I don't have is just because of chance. And there's no other explanation for it. It's completely random, which might leave one with a bitter taste. Why am I unlucky and other people lucky? And other people say, no, actually, there's a supreme controller. And the supreme controller is giving everyone whatever they have in this lifetime or don't have. But then one might think, why would he give some people more and some people less? And the answer might be that, well, it's a kind of a test to see how they can come out of it. But even in regular circumstances, for instance, in school, if we're given a test, we hope that we would get the same test as everybody else, at least on an equal level. It doesn't seem quite fair that somebody would be given a harder test than another person. Why would somebody be born with no legs, somebody else with legs? Why test variously like that? And how would it be appealing to give one's faith to a supreme controller who was arbitrary, or as Chaitanya Charan Prabhu likes to say, capricious? Just does it for whatever reason. And however, the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam give a third explanation, and that is that we are the architects of our future. And whatever we have now is due to whatever past activities we performed just as the team has worked hard, they've scored in a test match in over a couple of days, and they're way ahead. So Narada Muni then says that because of what we've done previously, we're already allotted a certain amount of happiness and distress in this life, on the material level. Certain things will come of their own accord, just as he says, misery comes of its own accord, even though we don't ask for it. Let's confirm that. You don't ask for it, right? Yeah. No. You don't wake up in the morning generally and make a prayer that, please, today let my car fall apart. Let my internet accounts be hacked. Let the IRS call. None of these things. In fact, you don't even like to hear it, right? So people go out of their way to try to ward off anything that might cause distress, but it comes anyway. It finds its way. As Chanakya Pandit said, just as in a huge herd of cows, the calf, you let the calf go and it'll find its way to its mother. In a huge herd of cows, and I've seen this before. At the time of milking, they let the little calf go. He doesn't even think, he just runs straight to its mother. It's uncanny. So in a similar way, he said, our karma comes to us. No matter where we go, whatever lifetime, karma comes running straight for us. And whether it's good karma or bad karma, it'll come. So Narada Muni says, you can be sure of this principle. It's a fixed principle that you're going to get the results of your past good and bad activities. However, he said, what's not fixed is your spiritual advancement. And he said, you can take full advantage of that. That's up to your personal decision. If you want to invest more in that, then he said, you can make advancement as much as you like, as much as you decide to surrender to the process of Krishna consciousness. So that's highly recommended that one decide upon this. At least theoretically, one should understand this paradigm that happiness and distress come of their own accord and you can't adjust it so much. So no need to work so hard to ward off unhappiness and to try to invoke happiness in one's life. But as soon as one understands that there's a possibility to advance spiritually, one should take advantage of it immediately and give as much energy as possible to that. So this is the basic impetus for human life. When one understands that human life affords such an opportunity, then one should run for it very quickly and take advantage. So there's various ways in which one can advance spiritually. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has said that there, particularly one should take advantage of spiritual knowledge, especially from the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, and should practice chanting a mantra. In fact, he mentioned that if a person who's wandering in this world and feeling a little bit distraught by circumstances, it's possible that one could live a perfectly aligned life, trying to do everything properly, but then find that there's discord in one's life, right? Yes, two people, three. And so he said, as one becomes aware of the fact that this is not, this doesn't seem normal to me, doesn't seem like my destiny. It seems like there's something more than this, and becomes sincere to know about the more, then naturally there's a way in which Krishna, who resides within everyone's heart, makes an arrangement. And the particular arrangement, he said, is that one comes in contact with a physician, a spiritual physician. And the physician carries a little black bag. They used to make house calls back in the old days, and they carry in their black bag some medicinal tools medicines and tools to see how we're doing. And so he said the devotee, the spiritual physician, carries the hymns and also the knowledge of Krishna consciousness. So the hymns means the mantras. A spiritual physician can give you a mantra, which is a spiritual, it's like medicine. In fact, Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his poem says, Enechi ashaudi maya nashi baro lagi. That the Maha Mantra, as we've just been chanting, is a kind of medicine that one can take to cure the disease of material life. And then one should also have some practice that's informed by the bhakti literatures that tell us exactly how to organize our life around the spiritual principles. So if one has these two things, then one can become self-determining, spiritually self-determining, by taking up the chanting of the mantra and then following the advice of the bhakti scriptures. So a couple points about the mantra. That the bhakti devotional mantras, especially the Hare Krishna mantra, they're sound formulas that have mystic potencies. So this is very interesting because everybody's looking for some kind of mystic potency. In fact, one of the interests people have in herbs and drugs and so forth is that they have some potency. In fact, when people buy herbs, they want to know how potent they are. There's different kinds of herbs. Some make stimulate your system. Some give you some psychotropic effect so that you can have a different perspective and so forth. People want to know what's the potency behind them. And there are, according to astrology, there are jewels that have various effects on us. This is something that Sanatana Goswami mentions in his Brihat Bhagavatamrita, that if regular things of this world, like herbs and jewels, can have potencies, so what to speak of mantras that come from the spiritual world? So one thing to remember and understand, the great gift that's given to us from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the devotees who act as physicians, and they go out distributing this medicine, is that the mantras they're giving, it's a special formula. You could even say a secret formula. But they have mystic potencies, mystical potencies. So this is something that one can look into and become enthused about. It's like, let me find out how this works. I'd like to try it. Adventurous personalities try all kinds of things in this world. In fact, there's shows about people who travel around the world and they try adventure. They'll eat anything. They'll go anywhere. They'll take anything. This is an adventure because consciousness itself is adventurous. It really has no limitations, consciousness. It's only when I come in contact with the limited material body that I start to experience limitations, but the impetus is always there to experience something unlimited. And therefore, one tries to come in contact with various substances or philosophies and so forth that will free the mind so that one can feel one's unlimited potential. So the mantra itself, the Hare Krishna mantra, has such mystical potency that if one takes this as a spiritual discipline to repeat the mantra and listen to it very carefully, then one's mind will expand and one will have a different perspective in life. One will be able to see the mysteries of the world, that behind every living being there's a spirit. One who sees like this is never bored or disappointed. For instance, it's mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita that a person who has attained this level of spiritual consciousness sees the spirit behind everything. Just as I read many years ago about how Native Americans had a sense of the spirit behind everything. And therefore they considered life kind of a sacrament. And the way that they interacted with nature was a sacrament also, because there was a sense that everything has a spiritual origin and everything is endowed with some spiritual potency. So Prabhupada used to point out that we can see within a lemon tree that there is what's called achintya shakti, or inconceivable mystic potency. How is it that a little seed turns into a tiny factory that puts out unlimited ascorbic acid? And all around us, there are these kind of miracles that come from consciousness, but I miss it all because I'm absorbed in a superficial kind of consciousness where I take everything for granted and I don't see such mystical things. But if I chant this mantra, it unlocks my inner vision so that I can see the spirit behind everything. Vidya vinaya sampane brahmane gavi hastani shuni chaiva shupakecha pandita samadarshina. In fact, a learned person, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, is one who has unlocked this spiritual vision. And every person such an enlightened being sees, he or she sees as a spirit. And Krishna says in the second chapter of Gita that when one sees the spirit, he'll become amazed. Ashcharyavat, he says, the spirit is the most amazing thing. What is it? People can't understand it. They hear about it, and it's inconceivable. What is spirit? Because I'm used to matter, and I identify with matter. But when I start distinguishing between matter and spirit, and examining spirit, and beginning to see it shine forth from the bodies of others, then I become amazed by it. And this is the way to live an amazing life, is to be amazed by the spiritual aspect. So the mantra, by its mystical potency, endows a person with this kind of vision to see that every living being is a spiritual being, doesn't really belong to this world. And if I see in that way, there's a different way in which I'll interact with the world and with other living beings. And also, if I'm able to taste the potency of any particular substance in this world, it might become intrigued by it and want to take more. So in a similar way, when I become intrigued with the mystical potency of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, then I may want to enter deeply within it. And there are records kept by people who have entered deeply within the mystical potency of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, describing its particular potencies. They've cataloged it, the kinds of things that you'll see, or the experiences that you'll have when you take it. And so one can take this mystical formula, and as a medicine at first, to purge oneself of the kinds of limiting belief systems that one holds within one's heart. There's a kind of purging that takes place. Yeah, that's very powerful. There are indigenous tribes in the Amazon that teach how to take various kinds of jungle herbs that have been passed down from shamans over many generations. And they have a kind of a potency to help people overcome temporary roadblocks. It's a sort of artificial way of dealing with these inequities and blocked vision. But the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is so deeply potent that just by chanting it, one will have this purging effect. But it is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam because it's completely pure. It has no side effects like other kinds of drugs that one might take. And because it's completely aligned, it's non-different from our original divine source, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that the effects are beyond what we might expect. In fact, one of the names of Krishna is Vanchatita, which means that he fulfills one's desires beyond what one can expect. So one can take the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra like this, as a drug, as a medicinal drug, And then you can expect, says the Shastra, that there'll be a purging period when you'll be vomiting out a lot of the bad influences that you may have taken in over many, many lifetimes. They're there packed up in the heart. I don't even see them, but they're blocking my progress. They're blocking my vision. They're blocking my ability to actually have complete gratitude and relate to every living being in a way that is in harmony with their nature. But by this Hare Krishna mantra, the mystical potency of this drug is so beneficial. It helps us to purge all that out. This is described in the Bhakti catalog. It's cataloged as there's a certain process, and one goes through the process when one accepts the mantra. First, one develops faith in the mantra by hearing about it from others. You know, can there be such a medicine, a drug that I can take like this? And then one starts to associate with people that that take it all the time, and you start to see the effects that it's having on them. You know, people who take other mundane kinds of drugs, like it's known they'll go to an opium den. So they go to these opium dens and they just hang out with people who take opium all day. And it's closed off to the world. They're fully dedicated to opium. They just smoke it all day and then just kind of lie there. But their lives become ruined. There's a temporary sense of euphoria. And you're able to shut off all your problems for a while. But then it all comes rushing back. And there are physical withdrawal effects, and there are ways in which all the things you left behind and didn't intend to will catch up to you, and so forth. But that's where people congregate when they want to dedicate themselves to opium, as an example, in a den. So this is kind of a den also. This is the mystical mantra den, where people come and they're like, what are you going in there for? It's like, I'll show you. You come in here. Should have somebody at the door, a little slot on the door. When they knock on the door, you open it. Who are you? Who sent you here? And you let them in. It's like, okay, I'll teach you how to take this. Here's the formula. You take it. And then you take it, and then there's others. You know, you can sit around and chant the mantra. And you take it home also. If you become addicted to it, you know, then there's a natural process that will take place. One will begin to feel the effects of this mystical drug. And as I was mentioning, anartanavritti, this is the technical term, that one becomes purged of previous misconceptions, which are extremely inconvenient for the unlimited spirit. He's held back by these things, limiting belief systems, thinking that I'm this body. That's the core limiting belief that I have, which leads to a constant fear in my life. I'm always thinking I'm going to die, or I'm not going to get enough. No matter what I get, it's not enough, because the very environment of the material world is fraught with this sense of scarcity, that there's scarce resources here. But in the spiritual, when one's in spiritual consciousness, there's a sense of complete abundance. Of course, that sounds redundant, complete abundance, just abundance, without any limitation. And that leads to a sense of intense gratitude, because one has a sense that all this abundance is coming from somebody. Somebody's providing me my life. Life is the most abundant thing, because it never ends. There's no sense that it's going to end. And this, Krishna says, is the point of the way in which an intelligent person thinks. He says, Yehi samsparshaja bhoga dukha yonaya evate adhyantavanta kontiya na te shuramate buddha. That is, he says, an intelligent person goes beyond the limiting beliefs of the material world. And that the limiting belief is that I am this body, and by interacting with the material nature in various ways, that I'll find happiness. But a person who has taken this potent mystical drug of the Maha Mantra opens his or her mind and starts to see that actually anything that has a beginning and end is limiting to my actual nature. It's out of harmony with my real interest in life. And therefore, na teshu ramate buddha, he said, then the person becomes buddha or intelligent and doesn't want to interact with things that have a beginning and an end. And then those devotees begin to confine themselves to those activities that put them more in touch with the spiritual energy, because they're finding happiness from that. In fact, it's mentioned, Ramante yogano anante satyananda chiratmani iti rama padena su brahma bhuya vidite. That the name of our original divine source, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is Rama. Everyone say Rama.
Rama.
Because from him flows unlimited pleasure. It's not limited by matter. It's unlimited. So the person sees this and therefore is always gravitating towards that and leaving behind the material nature, which has a beginning and it has an end. Any kind of pleasure, he eschews that. He says, this is not for me, and leaves it behind. Such a person develops what's called Paramahamsa consciousness. As a Paramahamsa is actually a swan. And just as a side note, there's a way in which we see that people who are not practitioners of bhakti, they're not actually tasting things themselves. They're looking at these ancient scriptures, but then translating them and looking at them from an intellectual point of view. They get things so wrong. In many of the translations of Hamsa, Paramahamsa, they describe that the Hamsa is a goose. Whereas actually Hamsa is a swan. And so it ruins the whole metaphor, doesn't it? Is there a difference between a goose and a swan? I mean, I love geese when they fly over, but they're considered sort of awkward, and you know, if someone calls you a goose, then you'll be offended, but if someone calls you a swan, you'll think like, well, thank you very much. I don't know what I did to deserve that. So a Paramahamsa is like a supreme swan. And what is that supreme swan consciousness? It is that to be able to see the difference between that which exists and that which doesn't exist. That which is my self-interest and that which is not in my self-interest. In the Gita, Krishna says there's two energies that the aware person becomes conscious of. One is that which exists and that which is it doesn't exist. One is wispy, it's insubstantial, it's always coming and going, whereas the other is abundantly and always available, it always exists. And one who experiences that through taking this drug of the Maha Mantra, sees it for himself, sees the difference between these two energies, is changed. They interact with the world differently. And they're able to, as a swan is able to take the combination of milk and water and only take the milk, and the water goes out the beak. And Bhadra Narayan Maharaj once told me, he said, I always wondered if that was just a myth. And then he said, I met a biologist from the University of Michigan. I said, what about this? Is there anything to this? And the biologist said, yes. The swan has an enzyme in its beak. And if it takes in milk and water, it can the milk coagulates because of the enzyme, and he's able to swallow it, and the water can go out its beak. That's what he said. So in a similar way, a person who, under the influence of this mantra drug, starts to be able to differentiate between the lower matter and the higher spiritual eternal substance, and starts to live in a different way, organize his or her life in a different way. And even while such a person is in the midst of the greatest clamor, or is even working to sustain one's family and so forth, he or she is aware of the difference of these two energies. There's a spiritual energy and there's a material energy. And as aware that they both come from the same source, but one is more desirable than the other. So this is one of the effects of the mantra, that this devotional mantra, they're sound formulas. Tried and true, it's been certified, and they have mystical potency. So if you take it, you'll go on, you'll be able to experience what you've always been looking for. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, you take this drug, you'll really get what you want. If you take other kinds of things that aren't authorized, whimsically try this or that, for a second you might see something, but then you'll come crashing down and end up possibly worse than you were before. So the word mantra also is derived from these two words, which are very important. Man, which means mind. And tra, which means to deliver, to be able to rise above. So why is this important? In the process of yoga, the mind is considered the either friend or enemy, according to how one has trained the mind. And in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna says that the mind has fearsome godlike powers over the self, the Atma, and is only for the, because of the unruly mind, that the living entity has been subjected or subjects himself to the troubles of the material world, life after life. The samsara means I'm flowing from one life to the next and having to deal with all kinds of difficulties because of accepting another material body, life after life. And so this is because of the power of the mind. So in yoga, the first objective is that one has to control the mind. So the mantra, in its very description, or the word mantra, means that it delivers the mind. So if one dedicates oneself to the process of yoga through the mantra, then one will find that the mind begins to... It develops a certain calmness. One becomes aware of the fact that one's different from one's mind, and that the mind can become calm and controlled by the process of chanting mantra, which is extremely difficult to do artificially. If you control the mind through artificial means, it may remain under control for a while, but then it will come back to its original state. Oftentimes in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's described that the mind is a very dangerous entity when it's not taken care of properly. In fact, one example is given in the fifth canto that it's like a wild animal. Sometimes a person captures a wild animal, puts it in a cage, feeds it, and it becomes tame. And then the person thinks, oh, he's tame. So then he becomes familiar with it and he leaves the cage open. And at night the wild animal comes out and eats his proprietor, tears him to shreds, and everything else in the house as well, and then walks back out into the wild. One yoga practitioner that I know well said, if you don't tend to your mind, if you become lax, he said, the illusory energy is so powerful. I made some comment about how Maya, which means the illusory potency of the Lord, of which I am enamored life after life, is very powerful. And he said, that's an understatement. He said, if you are lax in your spiritual practice and you give in to Maya, he said, she will eviscerate you. You know what that means? Tell us what it means. Give him the mic.
Last time I searched, so I it's like Narasimha Deva did the operation of Hiranyakasipu.
What did he do?
He took out all the entrails and all the
his entrails.
Entrails, yeah.
He pulled them out. Eviscerate? Yes? It means to pull out your guts. So he said, this was a god brother of mine, he said, if you're not careful, he said, Maya will eviscerate you. Not only that, she'll take your entrails and she'll walk them, wrap them around her walking stick and show them as a trophy that you've been conquered. So he said, Maya is nothing to trifle with. You have to be very careful. So one has to fortify oneself through the power of the mantra, and one has to train the mind to become attracted to the mantra. So I saw some people fishing recently. In Japan, a lot of people like to fish when they're retired. Any little pond or stream anywhere in the cities, Osaka, Tokyo, that I see when we're walking around, there's always old people there, and it looks like they have nothing better to do but fish. So they're fishing all day long. I'll even come back 2 hours later, they're still there fishing. So I watch them, and what they do, they throw this lure into the water, and then they pull it back in. And it's got a little, it's metal, it's got little hooks on it, it's like kind of flashy. So fish get attracted. They see something darting through the water, and they get attracted. And the mind just goes to it. We might experience this at something, if you're walking along, you might see something in your, it come into your purview. It'll attract your mind or senses, even before you notice it, right? What might you notice that will attract your mind? Your eyes just jump there and you go, hey, why'd you go over there?
Nice car.
A nice car, okay. Often it's a beautiful lady. So, you know, it's just the mind of, well, and hey, wait, you know. So fish are like that too. This is the like nature of the material world. The senses have their objects, and the senses are embedded in their objects. And so the fish, they see something darting through the water, and they go, ooh, that's nice, and they just go for it. They grab onto it, and then they get caught. So when I was watching one of these fishermen, I was thinking that it's much like mantra chanting, japa, they're doing. Because you keep dropping the mantra in front of your mind. Mind's like a fish. It darts all over the place. It jumps for this or that. So you have to keep throwing the mantra in front of it. So when you're chanting, you sit and then you toss it in the little pool of your mind or around your mind. Your mind's sitting there like a fish. And then you lure it past. Come on, come on, come on. And I see these guys for hours, you know, until they catch some fish. But they put it out there. But finally, you know, it goes by and the fish can't take it anymore. And he grabs onto it. So you have to sit there and fish for your mind with the mantra. You put it out and then you lure it past. And you put it out again, you just cast it out again, lure it past. But finally, if the mind grabs onto the mantra even one time, it can get caught on that mantra. Because it gets caught on everything else in the material world. Krishna says, Jayato Vishayam Pum Sam Sangasteshu Bajayate. That this is the cause of a repeated cycle of having to be subjected to the lower energy. That you look out into the world and you see things that look nice. And then you grab onto them. And you think, I like this. And as soon as you think, I'd like this, you contemplate it, think, I'd like this thing. Then your mind grabs onto it, and it won't let go. It gets caught on the little hook. So the process of mantra meditation is you take something from the spiritual world. It's a lure, and you put it down, and you keep putting until the mind hooks onto that and gets caught. So this is known as the perfection of yoga. If you're able to catch your mind on the mantra, but you have to fish for it, because that little fish likes to feed off the bottom of the pond and eat all kinds of garbage. It thinks, no, this is good. And it's like, no, take the lure, take the lure, take the lure. Boom, you know. And if you, every day you fish for your mind and you just keep running it past, you know. And even it's like, you catch anything today? Didn't catch anything today. Catch anything this week? Didn't catch anything this week. This month? No. And finally one day, I think you caught something, I can tell. You're different. It's like, yeah, I caught the mantra. My mind got onto it. And so you'll experience something when your mind actually catches onto it. So this is what great yogis do. They organize their environment so that they're always going after that mantra, the little lure that will catch the mind and pull it all the way out of the material world, just as the fish comes out of the pond. and he just, the fisherman pulls it out. So Krishna's up there fishing for us also. And, you know, if we catch on, he'd pull us out and take us home. So the mantra is the thing that the yogis go for. This is the great gift that comes down as a spiritual formula, and also the mantra. The tra has got that little R in it. It looks like a little hook for the mind. Mantra. You catch it, and you pull it back. And then also the mantra is compared to seeds. So just as seeds from various plants have distinctive genetic codes, mantras similarly have unique potencies. So those who are good gardeners and farmers, they put a lot of effort into the seeds. If you start from that point and you study seeds, where do they come from? Is it a reliable source? And you find out everything you can about the seed that you're getting. You study it. And you see, like, what's going to happen when you plant this? And then you have to know how to plant it, what time to plant it, and so forth, so that it'll grow. So in the same way, mantras are called bijas. They have the seed quality. There's something in it that's very potent. And if you learn about it, you learn where it came from, you'll become a connoisseur of the seed. And if you get the right seed from the right person, and then you plant it, it creates a miracle that grows into something that is unimaginable. In fact, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu used this metaphor again and again about gardening. He said that this spiritual impetus that one gets from another person who's already caught onto the mantra, this is like a seed. And if you water it and you put it in the right place, in the right environment, you take care of it, cultivate it, it'll grow from here all the way to the spiritual world, like a creeper. I have some jasmine plants in my backyard, and they've grown from the backyard all the way to my neighbor's house. They put these little runners out along the ground, and it goes for like 50 yards. And then it catches on in my neighbor's house, and then there's a drain pipe, and all the drain pipes, my same plant, it's grown up all the way into a big plant. So you can see how these creepers have a mind of their own. They know where to go. So the seeds that we're watering from the spiritual world through this process of bhakti, they know where to go. They're really smart. And they'll go right to the spiritual world. You don't have to think about it so much. You just have to water it properly. The plant knows how to grow itself. You don't have to figure that part out. And it'll grow all the way to the spiritual world and catch on to Krishna in the spiritual world. And then you can be living in this world, but by the power of the mantra, your consciousness is always in the spiritual world. Even though you're moving around here, people are saying, hey, listen, Perkins, did you finish that report? And you're going like, I finished the report. But you're still absorbed in the spiritual world, even though somebody's asking for a report, and normally you'd be like really annoyed, like, why did you ask me three times? But you're not annoyed because you already have you're already established in the spiritual world at the same time. Therefore, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Tasmat sarveshu kaleshu mam anusmara yudyacha mayarpita mano buddhir mami vaishyasya samshayaha. He said to Arjuna, who is not so into this idea of fighting in the war. You know, sometimes in our work, we come into a situation where we feel like, I don't want to do this anymore. Do you ever have that? Bhavik, you always liked it? Until yesterday. Anyway, you know, there's always changes in the material world. You may be doing your work, and then you think, like, I don't want to do this anymore. So that happened to Arjuna. And then he had this idea that I'll just quit my work. And Krishna said, that won't work. It's not going to work out. What you have to do is do the work at the same time, because you already have this momentum from the material side where you can't stop doing the kind of work that you're in the groove of. And he said, at the same time, bring in the mantra. Tasmat sarveshu kaleshu mama nusmarad yujicha. So he said, while you're doing the kind of work, even if you don't like it, if you keep the mantra going, the spiritual formula, then what will happen is it will transform you. So that while you're doing your work, you'll be thinking of the original divine source, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and you'll be connected to him, even as you're doing your work in this world. And then you'll be unaffected by it. And there's evidence of this in the Gita where Krishna describes a person who has attained this consciousness. He says, Naiva kinchit karomiti yukto manyeta tatvavit pashyan shinvan svasan jigran ashnan gachan svapan svasan pralapan vishanan grinan unmishan nimishanapi indriyan indriyateshu vartanta iti dharayan. That a person who has attained this divine consciousness, although engaged in picking up the, what's the report called, Gurna?
Report?
Yeah, that you have to pick up. You go to your office, you have to pick up a report. The Watkins file. Mr. Perkins, where's the file? Where's the file on Watkins? You know, you're going around, you're picking up reports, you're driving back and forth to the place where you got to pick it up. There's all these, you got to remember the combination, how to open the thing. Krishna's saying, we're doing all these things. You're moving about. Your senses are engaged. In this material world, he says, naiva kinshit karomiti. The person in divine consciousness is aware of the fact that I'm not actually, this is superficial to my actual existence, my real existence. All these things are on the external level, and I'm not really doing them. They're taking place by the force of the three modes of material nature, the way the material nature is working. But I'm on another level. I'm observing it, and I'm going through it, but I'm not part of it. It's not me. Asanga khyayam purushaha. Vedas say, little soul, you have nothing to do with this world. Don't worry. It's not you. This is not your place. You have nothing to do with it. You've just got a little caught up in it here, and we're going to get you out. We're going to pull you right out of this place. And so we brought you a little mantra. You hold on to this. You keep it, and it'll take you all the way back to the spiritual world. So satisfying. Read the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, and you see how the great hero of the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, not only does he get out of the material world just by holding on to his mantra, even though he didn't know what it was, but then he gave it to another and said, you know, this helped me. I think it'll help you. Just take it. And if you hold on to the mantra, even if you're not completely sure how it works, and you keep doing it over and over again, then what will happen is the mantra itself will take you by the hand and pull you out of the material world to the spiritual world. Because the mantra is non-different from our original divine source, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of God. And he has hands, and they can reach all the way down here, wherever we are, and pull us out. So it's an uncanny process that takes place. And we don't know which direction Krishna is going to pull us out from or when. He might wait till the last second. We don't know. It's up to him when he pulls or from which direction he pulls. But one thing's for sure, if you hold on to the mantra, the Vedas say, or the Srimad Bhagavatam says from the very beginning, apana samsrutim gaurandhyam nama vivishogrinan tata sadyo vimucheta yad bibheti swayambayam. It says, don't worry about fear in this material world, because the mantra is so powerful that if you keep it with you and take advantage of it, it'll scare away fear personified. Nothing to fear except fear itself, right, Karunath? Who said that?
Franklin Delano Roosevelt
said there's nothing to fear except fear itself, which is what the Srimad Bhagavatam says. It's an illusory condition, because I've identified myself as a material body. Sometimes people have out-of-body experiences where they temporarily their heart shuts down and they have to kind of leave their body for a few seconds. And they have a vision that they're hovering above the gurney or whatever they're on. You know, it's a drastic scene where somebody got hit on the head or something happened and the heart stopped and they put them on a gurney. They're going to take him in, try to revive him. And the person's aware and looking down and seeing, there's my body. And even some reports think like, oh, yeah, I see. That's not me. That's some body. And sometimes they feel like, I don't even really want to go back into that. Because we're very subtle, and it's a very gross kind of a machine. Everyone gets enamored of it and thinks, you know, I'm very beautiful or whatever. But it's not really. It's just a very gross covering of the actual soul. So we can have an experience of that through the mantra and see the difference between our gross body that we've taken on by just our involvement in the material modes of material nature. It's a kind of a calcification that takes place by being in contact that covers over our subtle, very subtle nature. So the mantra can do all that, and there's much more, much, much more. But those are a few points. But before we go to the next items, we'll take some reflections, which means anything that you heard so far that's stuck in your mind that you want to report back. Yes. Govinda.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. So I'd like to call into evidence two verses, 6:2:19 and 11:9:29. So the first one is actually around the medicine, the aspect that you are mentioning. Yatha agadam viryatamam upayuktam yadrachaya upayuktam yadrachaya ajanan api ajanato api atma gunam kuryat mantra api udaharata. So just as medicine is useful, even if we don't know the effect of it, it actually shows its effect, right? Similarly, the mantra also acts. And the second one was about the rarity of human life. Labdhva sudurlubham iti
sambhavante. Thank you for entering into evidence these two very important verses. The first verse that you mentioned from the sixth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam is in reference to Ajamil. And in this section of the Bhagavatam, which is called Poshana, the protection of the soul, comes right after the fifth canto, where the hellish conditions that are the soul is subjected to due to slipping into material consciousness are mentioned. And Parikshit Maharaj asks, what is the solution to this? And Shukadeva Goswami answers that Krishna has availed himself to the world through his name. And if one takes advantage of his merciful manifestation as his name, then one can be freed from the influence of the material world. And even if one doesn't know the potency of the holy name, if one comes in contact with it, it'll have its effect, just like medicine. And the other verse, labvam sudurlabham idam bahusambhavante manushyam artaram anityam pihadira, that the human life is very rarely attained, and it's extremely valuable. You can't buy it. You can't put in a chit and say, I'd like to have this. You just get it or you don't get it from the material nature. He said, and although it's very temporary, it has the greatest value because you can use it to elevate your consciousness. Thank you.
Yeah, along those lines, the song Udila Aruna says, Anechi Ashodhi Maya, the second part of the song talks about how Lord Chaitanya has come to give us the medicine, and it's the Hare Krishna mantra. And also you often quote the verse 325:25, Satang prasangan mamavirya sangvido pavanti ritkarna rishayana kataha. It becomes a medicine that goes through the ear to the heart. But what I was thinking of was in the early days of ISKCON, the devotees were being recruited from young people in America who were experimenting with psychedelic drugs and recreational drugs to bring about a euphoric effect. Anybody who's read Chasing Rhinos, that book by Shyama Sundar, can see how the drug culture was linked to, or you know, people were getting over the drug culture, and the devotees printed a pamphlet that said "Stay high forever," and they would go and distribute that pamphlet because those were the people they were preaching to, were people who were interested in getting high and experiencing euphoria from a medicine, but they were giving a better medicine by the mantra.
Yeah, a while back I was flying somewhere, I was in line, at the airport going through security with Huey Lewis, who wrote a song in the 80s that said, "I need a new drug." And he was describing how drugs have side effects. In fact, if pharmaceutical companies are required when they advertise a drug, they'll tell the benefit, but then there's about 5 minutes where they tell what all the side effects are. And it always, I'm like 50% of the time, it includes death. So, you know, he was picking up on the fact that, you know, the whole drug culture of the 1960s and so forth, there was some sense that they would find an alternative reality. However, the re-entry into the material world was not often kind to them. They wouldn't know how to actually regulate their senses and stay in that higher consciousness, if indeed it was higher consciousness to begin with. And there's all kinds of side effects, like addiction and so forth. There's an opiate epidemic now in America. And Bhakti Marg Swami, who just walked across America, was telling me, I walked with him in the last leg of his journey through San Francisco, and he was telling me that he came to some towns in middle America that were decimated because of this scourge of opiate addiction. All the young people were gone, and they were just addicted to these kinds of things. So these material drugs have their drawbacks. So he said, "I need a new drug, you know, one that doesn't have all these side effects, and this is the perfect medicine. What everyone's looking for, actually, you know, to take the magic pill, everyone wants that. To take it, and it will solve all your problems, and it put you in happiness always. And this is what's advertised. This is what we're advertising in the Bhagavatam. This Rishabha Deva says, Tapo divyam putraka yena sattvam shud yad yasmat brahma saukyam tonantam. What he's actually saying is, if you take this divine austerity, then you'll come to a point where you get unlimited happiness and it never ends, he says. So that's a good kind of drug. Yes.
A real bottle of happiness.
Yeah, a Coca-Cola advertised, open a bottle of happiness. So this is an indication everyone's looking for. They want to pop the thing open, and then, you know, it's like, whoa, now I've got happiness. And this is illusion. It's an idea that I'll get happiness from sugar water. But there's an image there of Coca-Cola that goes along with it. And the whole material world is based up on this, based on this imagery of a false self. It has nothing to do with my real self. I have a sense of my false self that I'm an American. And Americans wear blue jeans, by the way. And they drink Coca-Cola. And, you know, they run on the beach or they hang out. They don't care about anything else. And they look cool. Or whatever it is, you know, that's the image. It's like, I'm like that. And people look at you, no, you're not really like that. It's like, oh, I think I'm like that. So to open a bottle of happiness is what we all want, but yoga is the serious way to get it. And the mantra is the actual contents of that bottle. You open it up, you take the mantra, you have to drink it every day. But, you know, our teachers are not, they're not foolish. They teach us that when you open it up and you take it, at first it's going to be bitter. Because you're so used to taking junk food, if you take something nice, that you're going to think it's bad. So in the beginning, when you start taking this, they say, even if it's the best thing, just trust us, it's the best thing you can ever do for yourself. When you take it, you're going to think this is awful. And it takes people a while to change their habits in their life. This is part of the yogic lifestyle, is changing your habits so that you can actually take the medicine that's in the bottle. Yes, what else? You have one more, yes.
Yes, actually, the many points I like. One was where you're telling that Native Americans, how they were believing in the spirit and everything they were seeing as a spirit, that's such a nice way to connect the nature. And you were mentioning about how we want to be unlimited because we are conscious soul, we are unlimited, but because of body we become limited, and because we assume, we think that we are body. And one of the devotees who is very expert in making viral videos, he made a recent title that was like, and how to become out of the limited belief, and it has around 300 million views. That
300 million?
Million, yes. So and
that's
that,
a lot.
And the theme of the this is only how you keep yourself under certain limitation. So I think the solution he has just brought, but I think the real solution is.
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic.
It's a very interesting topic.
How I can subject see how myself to, well, we call it self-limiting beliefs. And the Vedas are really speaking to us quite directly and saying that you're doing this to yourself. You're causing this to yourself. You're actually a powerful entity, and you're creative. You're powerful and you're creative. But because of the way that you've developed a certain perspective, now you've limited yourself. And there's, you know, it's a very interesting topic because we are higher energy than matter. And this is described by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita when he says, he first catalogs all the material lower material energies or separated material energies, which in one sense means lower. Bhumir, apo, anulavayu, kammano, bhutirevacha, hankara, ityame, bina, prakritirashtada, earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and ego. These, he says, and this is helpful, it's Sankhya, it's like counting everything and saying, okay, this is this. It's not anything else but this. It's separated material energy. And he says, then, next verse, he said, there's something higher than this. Apareyam itastvanyam prakritim vidimeparam jiva bhutam mahabaho yayedam darite jagat. Said that the higher energy is you. It's the living entity. But you're struggling with the lower energy. How does that happen? So it's very interesting that the higher energy is creative. For instance, I was looking at my iPhone this morning, and I saw an article that said now people are going to create less smartphones because they think now it's too smart. So there's a whole new wave of phones coming out where they're going to try to dumb them down because this has gone too far. These things are too smart. And therefore, and it's like, why are they saying it's too smart? Because it's consumed your whole life. Everyone carries their phone wherever they go. If you go to a bus stop, you look, everyone's like this. If you look at somebody taking a nap, the phone's by their head. Everything dominated by the phone. So the higher energy of the living entity, it's very intelligent, it's creative, and it can look at the material energy and say, okay, there are electrons here. I just saw this when I went to Intel the other day. You know, how do you create a transistor? Now they can fit 300 billion transistors on one silicon space. Am I correct? Anyone? Yes. And how do they figure that out? You know, because living entities are smart, so they figure it out, and then they become captured by it because it's actually, although it's separated. Divine energy, although it's separated energy, it's divine. Krishna says, "Daiva hi esha gunamayi mama maya daraya." It's maya, it's illusion, and you can mess with it all you want, but you're gonna get caught by it. It'll catch you because it's still, even though it's lower than you, it's coming from a higher source, and therefore it'll capture you. So people are definitely captured by their iPhones. Or whatever, if you do that other, whatever the other phones, Android or whatever. So you get all these phones and it's like, you know, the living entity's in trance by the lower energy. But you made it. So this is what it means. He said you're interacting, the higher energy's interacting with the lower energy, but you're becoming caught by it all. You're becoming captured by it. Udayananda, right in the back.
Hare Krishna.
By the way, we'd like to welcome our good friend and God brother Udayananda Prabhu here to Silicon Valley. Please give him a warm welcome.
Okay. What was I going to say? I'm going to say one thing. I have so much love for Vaish because we were kids when we joined. I was much older than him. I was 19, he was 16. But we've known each other for so many years. And Two things came to mind when I saw Vaish yesterday, and I mentioned them actually to him, so I'm going to mention to the devotees. One was, I got second initiation from Srila Prabhupada in Chicago, and I was from the Detroit temple, but I used to go to Chicago and distribute books, and Vaish was there for so many years. So, and you know, there was the camaraderie of book distributors. You know, it was a brotherhood, right? And Suradas was our good friend, right? So Srila Prabhupada came. It was the first Rath Yatra in Chicago, remember?
Yeah.
So I got to get initiated, second initiation. I got to go in Srila Prabhupada's room all alone, just with me and Srila Prabhupada. And remember Sudama Maharaj? He was Prabhupada's servant. And he had, he was a very good servant. I was just amazed of how he was before Srila Prabhupada, kneeling, putting his salt and pepper and serving and getting this and just taking care of Prabhupada so nicely. I was Prabhupada's bodyguard at the time, actually. Sri Govinda gave me the service to do. So I was like looking in the room watching the whole thing going on. So he had put all, they had brought the Vyasasan from Detroit and put it into remember the Brahmachari Ashram,
yeah.
Right in that room. And so Prabhupada was sitting on this Vyasasan, and the lights were kind of low, and Maharaj had all this frankincense and myrrh burning in these pots. I mean, he had it like smoking. And it looked like, and it was all covering the floor. So when I walked into Srila Prabhupada's room, because I offered my obeisances, it was all this smoke, and it looked like a cloud. It looked like Prabhupada was sitting on a cloud, floating there. So Prabhupada went, there was a whole interaction. And I was, after he actually took my hand and he showed me how to say the Gayatri Mantra. And then, I was thinking, how many billions of births, like you were describing how the lure, that little lure going after the fish, you know, trying to lure it. And that's what Maya does. It just keeps luring us away from Krishna, away, birth after birth after birth. I thought, how many billions of births have I taken and not came in contact with the pure devotee of Krishna? And now I'm before the spiritual master of the universe. And I was thinking, this is like a momentous moment that I need to seize. And I thought, you know, what does one say to a perfect devotee of Krishna? And so I had read all Prabhupada's books. Actually, I joined in 1972, and then I moved in early 73, and then I'd been doing book distribution for a year and a half, and this was in 1974. So I'd read all of Prabhupada's books up to that point, and he had answered all my questions, so there wasn't like a question you would ask, right? So, remember they started Guru Puja in 1974, right? And I love Guru Puja, which incidentally, I'm sorry I missed this morning, but the lotus feet of the spiritual master is the only way we can attain pure devotional service. I bow to his lotus feet with great awe and reverence. By his grace, one can cross the ocean of material suffering and attain the mercy of Krishna. So I thought, those lotus feet, that's it. I need to get those lotus feet. I got to get the dust of those lotus feet. So Prabhupada gave me, and he asked me what I was doing in service, and he said, all right. So I offered my obeisances, and I worked up all the like strength and gumption in my heart to just blurt out this question to Srila Prabhupada. And I go, Srila Prabhupada. And he goes, yes. And then I kind of paused and I went, can I touch your lotus feet? And as soon as I said it, like my whole face turned bright red. Because I thought, did I just say that? Prabhupada looked at me and smiled and said, that is not necessary. So then I go, yes, Srila Prabhupada. So I offered my obeisances. And I walked out, and the first person I seen was Vaish and Sura. And they were like, What'd you say? Who'd I? I said, can I touch your lotus feet? And Vaish says, you are such a dork. I don't know why I said that. But that was the reason I said that. But anyways, they laughed and they chided me. So that was like a momentous. So every time I think of my initiation, I think of Vaish. Call me a dork. But then, later on, in 1977, I had the great opportunity to be in Vrindavan in October. And I was in Srila Prabhupada's room every day, actually. And one day, a letter came in, a Sankirtan letter, and they started to read the letter. They were having a big marathon in the New York temple. And the devotees were going out praying to Krishna, please, Krishna, if you will, let Srila Prabhupada stay with us. And so they were doing this marathon, distributing so many books, and they said, I don't know, it was like a week or 2 weeks, but they said, Pragosh Das, which is the American Pragosh, our dear friend, and Vaisheshika Prabhu distributed 120 Bhagavatams a day for 7 days straight. Prabhupada heard the letter, and then he said, read that to me again. And he read the letter, Vaisheshika and Pragosh distributed 125 Bhagavatams. And then Prabhupada's whole mood was changed. And he said, and he kind of got this energy. And he said, I want to go back to New York. I want to be with my preachers. And I want to be on the battlefield with my preachers. And he said, and if I die, you put my tomb on the roof of the 55th Street Temple. He says, I don't want to die here, you know, outside the battle. I want to be on the battlefield. So I was thinking, Vaish, you know, that's fantastic. Prabhupada wants to be with his generals. Well, he was more like a major at that time, but so those are the feelings, like you were talking, the lure. You know, you have to grab that and then let Krishna, the other point you made, Krishna is a person and he has a hand and he can pull us out. Hare Krishna.
Thank you. Hare Krishna Udayananda Prabhu. There's nothing more heartfelt than we don't know how we come into the circumstance of devotional service exactly. Krishna explains and Prabhupada explains in the Nectar Devotion, it's by divine arrangement. But when we do, those who we're able to serve side by side with become our eternal friends. You can see somebody 20 years later and you still have a heartfelt connection because you were there, forgive the you know, the metaphor, but in the trenches. It's cliche, but it's extremely heartfelt, and as the years go on, one realizes more and more the value of that. When we're in the moment, it's hard to understand the, as you said, the moment, momentousness of the occurrences that are in our lives at that time. But as time goes on, one gets that perspective of how powerful they are, and not the least of which is our relationships with our God brothers and God sisters, who somehow or other showed up at the same time. You know, we all came at different eras into the Krishna consciousness movement, and that was definitely by divine arrangement. I mean, we didn't think it up. Krishna had everything to do with it. So it's a very heartfelt connection that we have, and we always will have. It's the greatest gift to have that connection with one's God brothers and God sisters in the spirit of service to the spiritual master. Thank you, Uday Prabhu. Hare Krishna. Kuchira Koso. Right back at you. Yes. You have internet. Okay. Okay. Shraddha Devi Dasi has comments from the internet and also something that she wants to say.
First from the internet. Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Adam from DC.
Oh, Hare Krishna, Adam.
After experience with ayahuasca, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, it's that thing that you just mentioned.
Yes.
Take, you know, for 10 years in the Amazon, the number one thing that it never gave me was the ability to do spiritual healing and purging work without imbibing the plants. I left because I saw too many people growing dependent upon it rather than cultivating sadhana or love of God, which I felt was very important. Impersonalism was also very dominant. And in the Amazon, a shaman might traditionally administer this medicine once, if ever in a person's life, for physical ailments. Western spiritual skydiving mentality has really reached the culture surrounding its medicinal use in Amazonian herbalism. At any rate, you put it so well. Thank you for these illuminating insights. The holy name are the real and eternal medicine. Hari Bol.
Yeah, just for some context, this is Bhakta Adam. He's a writer and an accomplished astrologer. He has a couple of master's degrees in both literature and also creative writing and so forth. And a very unique life. He grew up as son of a minister. And he also spent time in the Amazon taking this sacrament that shamans give there in order to elevate one to a higher perspective in consciousness. And then this is before he came in contact with Krishna consciousness, but then he has many realizations, as he's just expressing, which I'm basically just reiterating in the context. And that is that, you know, he saw that although people went there to the Amazon to take a certain kind of drug that was meant to be consciousness altering and ego effacing and so forth, there is a way in which they became dependent on that substance. Prabhupada mentions this in a conversation with Allen Ginsberg, because LSD was all the rage at the time that Prabhupada came to San Francisco and New York, especially San Francisco, thanks to Shamasundar, actually, because he was the main distributor, he and one other person, of LSD in the world. Owsley Stanley was making it. It was before it was illegal, and they took it upon themselves to travel around the world and distribute it. And he was pointing out to us once historically how wherever he went, he started seeing counterculture come up from these kind of drugs. But very helpfully, Adam's pointing out that there's a limitation to this. Just as Prabhupada was saying to Allen Ginsberg, you don't need a substance. Substance is limiting. There's a dependence you get from it. And something material can't reveal to you the highest realm. Even those who speculate on God using their mind can only come to the point of impersonal understanding. And similarly, there's a way in which through some kind of a drug, one may conclude that the material world is insubstantial, my ego is also superfluous, and so forth. But then there's a re-entry into the material world. It doesn't necessarily mean that you get to keep all these realizations. And even if you did, the highest that you might come to is an impersonal understanding of God. To have the complete Purnam understanding requires a descension of mercy from a higher level through the process of bhakti. So in his sojourn, he describes the ways in which he went through various religious experiences with his father, growing up as a minister, and also going to the Amazon to find himself through through guided process with a shaman to try to reach higher consciousness through a substance, which I can't pronounce either. What is it called?
Ayahuasca.
Thank you. For 500 points. What is ayahuasca? And then coming to the realization that through the process of devotional service and realizing that there's a supreme personality behind it all, which is a very, well, to say the least, edifying realization that can be had really by the mercy of devotees. So thank you for checking in, Bhakti Adam. Really good to hear from you. Hare Krishna. What else?
So Maharaj, I wanted to share two things. In the beginning of the lecture, you had mentioned Jivana Jalamala. Jivana Talamala, Jivana Kamala Jaladala Jivana.
It's such a beautiful phrase too, isn't it? Yeah. Jivana Talamala. Yeah.
Kamala Jaladala.
Kamala Dala Jala Jivana Talamala. Beautiful alliteration in poetry.
Yes. Yeah, it's really nice. And I was also thinking about the cricket the cricket match that you mentioned, and
it's a test match.
Yeah, it's a test match. And you were asking for the score. So
Kurnath, you know what a test match is? One thing, the first thing ever that he didn't know about. Okay, go ahead.
So,
okay, go ahead.
So I was thinking about that there are two types of test matches. There are 5-day and there are 1-day test matches.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So the 5-day ones seem to be very boring because they have 5 days to score.
Yes.
But the 1-day matches are very intense and the people really give very good performance and they're very amazing to watch. You can eat like that. And and I was just thinking that, you know, that is because they know they have only 1 day to do, and which is the same thing as Kamala Jaladala Jivana Talmala. When you realize that, then you really give it your 1 day brilliance there.
Very good.
And,
nice.
and also while we were coming to the temple today, I saw a billboard on 101 close to San Antonio, and it said, outthink, outsmart, and outbrilliant. And I was thinking that we can use the mantras to outbrilliant Maya, you know, otherwise she will inviscerate us.
Eviscerate, yeah. Nice points. There's a term in time management called force deficiency, through which you have to have a point in time that there's a deadline. In fact, I saw a bumper sticker once that I could relate to very much. It said, if it wasn't for the last minute, I wouldn't get anything done. And unless there's a point in time that, you know, we're required to hand things over, then might just while away the time for the rest of my life. And as far as out-brillianting the competition, Prabhupada mentions that you have to be dexterous in order to cheat death before death cheats you. Don't be a fool and forget about it. In the pastime of Judd Bharat's father, who tried to train his son, who was pretending to be retarded so that he didn't have to interact with the world, one of the verses says that death came along, and although Judd Bharat's father had forgotten about death, death didn't forget about him. It came right at the right time and took him away. So in a similar way, the other day in New York, we were talking about preemptively giving. We don't really have anything. We're just stewards of whatever we have very circumstantially and temporarily. But if one becomes smart enough to give away those things, before they're forcibly taken by the course of material nature, or by the course and the force of material nature, then one gets credit for them. But if you remain attached because of weakness of heart, and then they're taken forcibly, you don't get any credit at all. You're just considered one of the unfortunate souls of the material world. Any other points? Yes. Sri Antariksha.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. I like the point you mentioned about how the creepers in your home, they made all the way. The runners, they have a mind of their own through all the backyard and then through your neighbor's home and then up the drain pipes. And so all we need to do for the Bhakti Lata is just hearing and chanting, and it knows where to go. So.
Yes. The seeds are smart. That's why they're seeds. And we just have to really know how to take care of them. And that's much of what the bhakti literature is. For instance, if you go into the concise guide for bhakti, which is called the Upadeshamrita, Rupa Goswami gives, you know, it's like a gardening book. It says, here's how to take care of your seeds. And he said, here's six things that'll kill it. Here's six things that'll nourish it. And it's delicate also. That's another thing that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says. Don't take it for granted. Because the bhakti creeper, when it starts to grow, it's very delicate, and you don't want to smash it. You know, gardens, you have to be careful. Anybody who gardens knows you have to line things up properly. Otherwise, there's so many things that can get your garden. There are pests that, and I hate to call them pests because they're just trying to earn a living themselves. And then there's weeds, same thing. You know, but you have to be selective if you're going to grow a garden. And you also have to water properly. And there has to be the right temperature and so forth. And all these things are listed there in the Upadeshamrita and other books as well. But if one takes the basic points, as usual, the very basic points, Madan Gopal Prabhu, welcome to ISV. And your wife's name? Golokeshwari Gayatri. We welcome you to ISKCON of Silicon Valley. Please give them a warm ISKCON of Silicon Valley. I must say, when I saw you come through the door, my heart jumped for joy. Because I think I just see Lord Chaitanya's arrangement that you've walked into our lives here at ISKCON Silicon Valley. And if there's anything any of us can do for you, please don't hesitate to ask at your beck and call. Please observe who they are and make sure you go out of your way to befriend them and give them everything possible that they can, that they need to have a happy life. In this world and in this Krishna consciousness movement, and very particular here at ISV. Okay? If you agree, say Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Okay, Hare Krishna. Sorry to embarrass you. Yes. Another point from Hansapriya, and then we're coming back to Shraddha. We got a rally going here.
I like the analogy how the, like, R is like reeling back the mind. And then bringing it.
The R is like
it's like intra, a hook.
It's like a hook. Yeah, it's a little hook on there.
Hook and just mantra. Really. Yeah. And actually, while I was traveling, I saw in Venice, one guy had actually three rods sitting on it. And he was sitting in the back. So when you gave this analogy, I thought that you could actually become a master of reeling the mind too. I mean, that's a possibility by slowly, you know, luring the mind back, and you can gain the
maybe
strength.
That's like 64 rounds or 100. Put more rods in there. And I was thinking, Pastor Uday Prabhu, and Udayananda Prabhu, and then there's a way in which, I was just remembering the description of watching these fishermen in Japan, they're very patient. They wait for a long time to get one little fish out of that stream, you know, and they're just like they just keep doing it. And that's sort of the idea behind this japa. You know, don't get all passionate and start jumping up and say, "Where is it?" You know, just stay there and keep fishing, and be happy with the process and just know that, you know, the mystery of it is sometime or other somebody's going to jump on the line. Yes.
Another nice analogy that you were making is that the Mahamantra is a drug. And everyone, because the material world is a painful place, aparamabhuvanaloka punarabhatunarjuna, right from the highest planet down to the lowest, they're all places of misery where repeated birth and death takes place. So why do people go into these dens, right, to the opiate dens, or why do they go out and drink alcohol? Why do they give intoxicants? Because they're not happy in the present state of consciousness. And we can't think that somehow or other, without Krishna, we can just, you know, push off all of the distraction, all the suffering, the adhyatmic, the adhibhautik, the adhyatmic. You can't do that. But if you get intoxicated, you take that drug of the holy name, that will give you the opportunity to transcend all the rest. Otherwise, you don't have a chance against Maya. So you have to become intoxicated. It kirtan japa, become intoxicated with the holy name.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I saw it somewhere earlier in my notes, but I'm not going to look down at them now because it'll take too long. But this is a point Krishna makes in the Bhagavad Gita where he says that vishaya vinivartante niraharasate hina rasavarjam rasopyasya param drishvanivartate. A very helpful verse. He says, at first one may restrain the senses from their objects, but still the taste remains. However, when one experiences a higher taste, then one becomes absorbed in that, and the lower tastes are forgotten. They now become insignificant. And I like your point. It's that, you know, when we get the higher taste from the mantra, then naturally we're able to give up all the lower tastes, and it becomes a automatic way that we do that, because it's our nature to search for higher happiness and to try to taste higher happiness. It seems almost obvious that, you know, you see people around you, for instance, with opiates. You know, you take opiates and then there's a high price to pay for that. You know, first of all, it's such a deep impression on the brain that it's impossible to forget it. And then you have to keep coming back to it. And then you see the results. The other thing is that your body becomes tolerant. It develops a tolerance. So then you have to take more and more. It doesn't even have an effect anymore. It tapers off. But the drug we're talking about has, we don't develop a tolerance to it. It actually increases, right? It transforms us.
The only side effect is satchitananda.
Actually, I was thinking the side effects are described really technically as knowledge and detachment. Vasudevi bhagavati bhakti yoga prayojita janaya yashu vairagyam jnanam chayanaitakam. That if you do direct service to Krishna, especially chanting Hare Krishna, then as side effects or concomitants, you get knowledge and detachment from the world. And that those are actually helpful because you need those in order to keep moving forward on your path of devotional service. I liked milking these metaphors. We'll just sit here all day. And that's another metaphor in and of itself that we can...
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj, I was just thinking about how important it is to hear the importance of mantra. Why? Because over the period of time, even we chant, we really sometimes miss because of the influence of Maya or the world we live in. So the deep discussion about this mystic drug, the importance of it, it brings you back to that one. So thank you very much.
Yeah, you have to have that every day. And it's like Weight Watchers. People can't lose weight in this world. It's very difficult. See, you're all laughing. It's very difficult to lose weight because, you know, we want to eat. We want to live and be happy. And you want to eat nice stuff, you know. Makes you gain weight. So the only way to do it is to go to Weight Watchers. So Weight Watchers has Sambandha Gyan. It has Abhideya and Prayojana. So the prayojan is they have a scale there, and the scale is precise. It's a government-tested scale. You know to the ounce how much you weigh, and there's no lying. You know, they make people get on the scale, and then it tells you exactly what it is. And when you come back the next week, it tells you exactly what you are the next week. So there's no getting around it. So you have to have some prayojan, some, you know, very clear goal that you can measure when you're moving forward in devotional service to say, this is where I'm at. And then you also have to have samban again. So Weight Watchers, they have classes for everybody walks in, and then they give them a big class. They give them all kinds of literature information every time that says, you know, this is what healthy food is, this is what bad food is, this is where, that's going to make you gain weight, lose weight, so forth. Talk about lifestyle changes, exercise. It's comprehensive, and you have to have that. Otherwise, it's natural course that by nature, you just start drifting off into another way. And then the Abhideya is there, that they have a point system, and that you only get a certain number of points per day, and you have to follow it. And if you cheat, like, there's a thing about, why is David Dutta fat? We never see him eat, so the conclusion is he must eat at night. I've never seen him eat before. He's pretty fat. He must eat at night. So, you know, the process of devotional service is very clear like that. There's samban again, and you have to hear every day. Otherwise, the mind will get some other stupid idea. It's like, let me take heroin. That's like the stupidest thing anybody can do. It's right up there with Coca-Cola. But, you know, they look at a sign and go like, yeah, maybe that's a good idea. Or they hear some jazz musician took heroin, and so they think, yeah, I'll be like a jazz musician. Stupid. But they do it. So you have to have a voice of reason coming from a higher level, like the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, and say, no, do this, not that. And it's very clear. The sages and Krishna are very clear about what to do, what not to do. And unless you hear it every day, then you'll get some other crazy idea in your head, and you'll say, yeah, I'll be a cool jazz musician. And so those three things, if you keep them constant in your life, and Prabhupada set up the perfect system in ISKCON, he knew exactly what everybody needed to stay on that thing. You hear daily class, actually morning and evening. He wasn't taking any chances. He said morning and evening. Because by the end of the day, it's like, yeah, maybe something else. And no, sit down and listen to class, you know. And when you wake up in the morning, sit down and listen to another class, you know. If you don't do that, then there's no wonder your mind will run off into a field somewhere. It's like, hey, look at me. And you're like, you look really stupid now. So, you know, you have to have that, and you also have to practice intensely. You have to have your own experience by chanting and taking the medicine on a regular basis. And then you get back on the scale, and the scales don't lie. If you're not blissful, if you're cheating somewhere along, somebody's going to look at you and go like, yeah, I get it. You're not practicing. You're not really doing this. And if someone follows, the result will come. It's sure and certain. Last one. Where's Avantika?
In the same vein, like how advertisement company, they know this sambandh gyan very well. So they keep on putting the advertisement again and again, again and again, till the time our mind become attached to that. It's always inspire me to see that how we should have also scriptures again and again. Otherwise, it just gets attracted to.
Yes, it's very interesting that the living entities are, you know, they're part and parcel of Krishna, so they're the same spiritual energy, but they're tatastha, means they can flip at any time. Don't be surprised if you're taking care of somebody or, you know, you're teaching somebody and they're like right on the right track and you come back a while later and they go like, I'm going the opposite direction. It's like, why? I'm a living entity. That's what I do. I flip. So if you don't want to flip, you have to stay connected to the sambandha, abhideya, and prayojana. And if you don't want your people to flip, you have to keep watching over them. Because if you let them go for a few days and you come back, they'll go like, hey, yeah, I went the other direction. It's a pretty tough job being a Goshtiyanandi. You have to watch out for living in it. Little flippers everywhere, flipping this way and that way. Right? Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman.
Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, hey, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman.